Yep, looks like we're all here.
Okay, well, welcome to the virtual meeting of Clallam PUD Commission on August 24, 2020. So we'll call this meeting to order. First item is approval of consent agenda, which I think we've all had a chance to look at that. If we have questions or exceptions, we can talk about those.
I don't have any questions.
So do we have a motion?
Yeah, I have a motion that we approve the consent agenda that includes the three items. First, the minutes of the August 10th, 2020 regular meeting. Second, the claim vouchers for August 10th through August 17th. And third, the payroll vouchers for the period July 16th through July 31st.
I'll second that motion to approve the consent agenda.
Okay, thank you. It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for August the 24th, 2020. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Agenda revisions. Doug, do we have anything?
No, not today.
Okay. What about the commissioners?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay, good. I don't need it. So our next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have comments? Or?
If anybody wants to make a comment at this time, please give me your first name, and I will go in the order I receive.
Doesn't look like you have anything.
Yep, hearing none.
Okay. All right, our next item is the business items, which we only have one. And that's the acceptance of contract completion to contract number 180806. Tom, are you on? Tom Martin?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, get at it.
Good afternoon, commissioners. This is the Deer Park Road pumping project. So three pump stations were, excuse me a second. About that. Three pump stations were constructed on Deer Park Road to enable a backup source of water for the Upper Fairview water system. And construction was completed in mid-May. And Harbor Pacific Contractors was the construction firm. And their work is complete. And staff recommends that commissioners accept this work as complete.
Now, we did it temporary initially. Now, this is the permanent installation, and it's all complete.
Is that is correct. Yeah, temporaries were put in during the 2015 drought.
Yeah.
And this completes a bilateral compliance agreement with the Department of Health to provide that backup water supply for Upper Fairview.
Okay, great.
That agreement is now over.
And that will only be used when the Morris Creek water levels get down and we can't take water from there, right?
That is correct. And we might be facing that in a couple weeks.
Yeah, it's getting there.
Yeah.
Okay, comments, questions?
Yeah, Tom, did we have any change orders? I'm sure we did, but what was the nature of, you know, final cost versus going in? Was this a fixed price contract, and how did we do?
This was a fixed price contract, and as you see in the table there in the memo, I'm not sure if you have that memo, but the original contract amount was $1 million. $440,840, and the change orders amounted to $45,614, which is about 3.2% of the original contract amount, which is pretty good for a lump sum project. And the nature of the change orders were that we had to add a chlorine analyzer and do some additional programming for the controls, raise the slab elevation of one of the pump stations. There were 8 change orders in total.
Now that's go ahead.
Pretty track record there.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. That chlorine analyzer was a requirement by health or?
Well, the chlorine analyzer was something that we, monitoring of the distribution chlorine, something that Department of Health wanted. We took this opportunity to put the chlorine analyzer in the pump station so we wouldn't have to send crew out there overtime on weekends to monitor every day.
Yeah, before they were catching samples, this is online continuous monitoring, huh?
That is correct, and it's tied into SCADA as well.
Sounds great. Any other questions? I have a motion.
Yeah, I think you answered my questions there. So I'll motion that we accept completion memo 180806 for the completion of the Deer Park Road Pumping Project with Harbor Pacific Contractors, Inc. for a total cost of $1,617,142.60, including Washington State sales tax.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve completion memo 180806 for acceptance of contract completion for the Deer Park Road Pumping Project with Harbor Pacific Contractors, Inc., for a total cost of $1,617,142.60, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Looks like we could have got them knock off 60 cents at least, but oh well. All right, that's our business item. Correspondence communication, Doug?
Yeah, nothing today, Will.
Okay, great. Commissioner reports.
Okay.
You normally go first, but.
Yeah, I'll go first here and highlights from the 12th of August NOAANet meeting. Probably a little background first, but back in June, I think I reported from the NOAANet meeting that Russ Elliott from the Washington State Broadband Office advised us that there's $300 to $400 million in federal funds available for rural broadband. Mentioned that it is an expensive, lengthy process, that it was unlikely that most PUDs would be able to pursue, you know, perhaps, you know, Clark with over 200,000 customers or Snohomish PUD with, 350,000, maybe they would be able to, but none of the other PUDs really aren't that big. So the thought was is that perhaps NOAANet could be the UTC-approved ETC provider. And I probably should back up on that also because in order to get the federal funds, the recipient has to be a UTC-approved ETC, which to add to your telecom acronyms, means eligible telecom company. So ETC is required for the status is required for those funds, and that would have to be granted by UTC to whatever entity they're receiving the funds within 6 months. And there's also FCC approval required to get the funds. So at that meeting, I recall they mentioned that, you know, the best way to go forward on this is to try and get NOAANet to be recognized by the ETC as an ETC so it could, you know, get the funds for the utility owners of NOAANet and possibly other public power entities. In a consortium bid, I think, was the way they described it. Now, at the last week or the 12th of August meeting, it was mentioned that the UTC won't confirm ETC status for NOAANet. So it looks like that's not going to be a way to get federal funds for expanding broadband by any means. Steve did mention at our board meeting, our last board meeting, also mentioned at the NOAANet meeting that we are pursuing public works grant funding to at least $4.1 million, which should get us into a good start for a broadband backbone to run out to Forks so we can get into some of the most underserved areas of the county where we need better coverage. So other discussion at the NOAANET meeting, during Dave Spencer 2019 evaluation by the NOAANET board, Dave Spencer is the CEO of the NOAANET. He was challenged to develop financing options for new business opportunities. And just for a frame of reference, past financing has included bonds, also included member-backed bank loans, and then also direct member loans. So in the current financial environment, at this meeting, they recommend that probably the best way to pursue financing for additional projects is to go with bonds because the environment for bank financing is not nearly as good as going to the bond market right now. Recommending 10-year, $10 million worth of bonds. Not all members are ready to jump on this, and I think Steve recommended we take a pause on this. So we're going to be discussing this further at the September 9th NOAANET meeting. So that's pretty much it for the NOAANET meeting. I also attended the Squim Dungeness Chamber meeting, and the real estate construction side of the economy there mentioned that the real estate market was pretty heated up a couple of months ago, but now it seems like there's even more buyers out there, and there are more of them looking at raw land and doing new construction compared to before, just because there's not a great inventory of pre-sale, pre-occupied houses. So that bodes well for new connections for the PUD, although I don't know that it's going to happen real fast just because you talk to any contractor and they're all pretty well backlogged. So, it's going to be a healthy construction market for the foreseeable future. And that's all I have today.
Thank you, Dave. Jim?
Okay. Let's see. Am I on video? Yeah, I am. Well, first I'd like to report, Nicole, I did take your truck, your PUD punch-out truck thing, and one of my kids did put it together. So anyway, we successfully completed this very difficult modeling project. So thank you.
That's a milestone. Looks pretty good.
I don't know if I'll hang it on the wall with my airplane. So
it's okay. Not radio controlled?
I don't think so. Nicole, is there a radio control kit for this thing?
No, if any of you would like one, I can get you one of these. It's just a paper cutout. That's okay. Pretty cute. Thanks for putting that together.
You bet. First thing I'd like to report on is I attended or listened in on Bonneville Power's quarterly business review, both the short meeting and the workshop. And at the QBR itself, Meinzer was the first one to speak. He gave a pretty long scripted speech about, the shape of BPA. He's, very satisfied with the way he's leading it with the energy imbalance market, the EIS being completed, the surcharge, so forth. So that was, his good news story. One thing he said, though, about the EIS that kind of got my attention is he put a lot of credit on the amount of work and effort that went into basically, I don't think he used the word negotiating, but working, getting all the positions of the various stakeholders into the decision, in other words, into the preferred alternative. And that's a little odd to say that about an environmental impact statement, because basically the purpose of the study is to basically take science along with relevant economic data and basically lay out a decision based on the science. And it's not supposed to be a deal between different parties and so forth. But I think that's indicative of the process and why you see such a big bust between a lot of the data in the EIS and what the conclusion was in terms of the preferred alternative. and which, by the way, is going to cost ratepayers no matter what you, no matter how you cut it on that preferred alternative. They also talked about the surcharge issues at this QBR, and we're very proud to point out that it doesn't look like there'll be another surcharge because reserves have increased, and the primary reason they increased was due to secondary sales were above forecast. I don't know exactly what they forecast, but they said it was $119 million more that they made on secondary sales. The WAPAG folks asked, well, how did that happen? How could the secondary sales be so much more? And they quoted high volume and higher prices. But the price thing is while the volumes, according to BPA's operations reports, are there, the prices aren't. The mid-sea prices are for the third quarter were basically $10 a megawatt hour less than last year. So anyway, I'm not sure how they got to that forecast, but anyway, that's hopefully that will hold true by the third, fourth quarter, I mean, and that it's not just a forecast issue. I did ask a follow-up question, how much power did they sell at mid-sea prices? And I didn't get an answer. Apparently the BPA staff was no longer available to answer questions when I asked the question. And so I don't know how much mid-sea they're selling at mid-sea. I also asked about a chart in the appendices about the amount of debt and debt swaps and stuff like this, and they couldn't answer that question either. So, because they said the BPA staff wasn't on the phone anymore, and I thought that was kind of odd that this is the technical workshop for BPA's quarterly business review, but the BPA staff is not on the line when you need to ask them a question. So, that's how that went. I participated in the Clallam's executive development conference call on the 19th, and Colleen had Kilmer there to speak, and some of his points, basically from Capitol Hill on the COVID situation is that, and you probably are aware of most of this, that there's no agreement on testing. There's no agreement on state and local, funding. And of course, this is something that the White House is not in favor of, whereas the Democrats are, and that's a big rub. He pointed out that, as an example of how bad it is for Washington State, over the next 3 years, Washington will be short $8.5 billion. And so, to making that up without any kind of federal assistance is going to be extremely difficult. A lot of stuff's going to get cut and so forth. He mentioned that all this stuff that they're doing in Washington, D.C. to help is referred to as stimulus, and he said that's not stimulus. That's just basically patching up the disaster we're in right now with money to try to keep us from sinking any further. Stimulus in his book is infrastructure investments and so forth like that, like modernizing the grid, building resiliency, and so forth and so on. And so I thought that was a pretty good comment. So those are the meetings. I'll just point out that Waputa, George Kahn sent back a response from Kurt Miller from Northwest River Partners about the TMDL. My response to his presentation on the total maximum daily load for temperature in the Snake Rivers. And Kirk came back with a response about border conditions and so forth. And I clarified that again the other day and sent it out to George this morning. Doug, I sent that to you. So if you could forward that on to the other two commissioners and staff there, I would appreciate it.
Okay. I just got it before the meeting, so I'll send it out to the others.
Right. The other thing that Kurt did is he included with his letter to George that George sent out to, I guess, everybody in Waputa, is that his comments to the EPA TMDL report. And so as I look through those, I really noticed some really weak arguments that they're making and basically are trying to shoot down EPA's data, which is actually BPA and USGS data, which is kind of weird. with some old core data that I'm personally familiar with when I was at Walla Walla, and that stuff is flaky. It's spot readings and stuff like this, but because it has high temperatures, they've cherry-picked it, and now, and it's been used for 20 years, is the reason that the Snake River dams do not warm up the reservoirs, and that it, in fact, the free-flowing river at times is hotter. And that's just simply, on averages, it's not true. Sure, you can always find a place in a river that's going to be hot, but for every, you know, but that's just normal. Rivers have cold spots and they have hot spots, and everybody knows that. And if the temperatures were as what as Kurt was alluding to, is if paper had been over 70 degrees for the periods of time he's talking about, salmon would never existed, never have evolved in the Snake River in the first place. So anyway, I sent that back, and I'm doing some further temperature work with some guys in the core on this thing too. So I'll be sending that out. And I think that's all I have, Will.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add. I did call in to the NOAANet meeting. Steve Schofer made a pretty good statement that, you know, we need to look at NOAANet management needs to perhaps scrutinize their processes of chasing what was called bluebirds, the bigger counts that require a lot of capital spending. These big accounts like, and I'll use Amazon, Microsoft, on, they require updating. They want the latest technology. They want 5.9 service and so on. So it's pretty costly to accommodate those. And Steve's comment, and I agree with this, that, you know, should we look at that and see if revenue can justify making those big investments. And this is the reason NOAANet has to go back to the well so often for additional funding. The other item that was discussed is whether or not participants, members of NOAANet, will underwrite debt. Now, the bylaws say that we will, but basically, in my mind, it comes down to what kind of agreement you have with a lender. And the difference is significant. We had a firm called, RBC. They track capital markets. And they came back with saying, well, if you go into an agreement with a lender that the participants in NOAANet will underwrite the debt, then the interest rate will be significantly less than if the participants do not underwrite the debt. Now, maybe it's a moot point because the bylaw says that we will. And if they reach an agreement like that and we don't agree with it, then our only option is to exit NOAANet, which is probably not a good idea. So it's kind of a bone of contention there. Previous management of NOAANet got into this 911 project, and the contract was kind of loosey-goosey. That CEO didn't run that contract by their attorney. There was no failure to perform in there on the parts of the customer. And the delay meant that they invested a lot of money up front, and then there was no revenue coming in to cover it. So that was the last iteration where we had to pony up some money, and other participants had to pony up money for NOAANet. So anyway, it's an interesting discussion. Don't know if there's a philosophical gap between participants and management or not. I guess this latest thing of going back for a bond issue might daylight that and just see what the discussion is. I've got a workshop over at Suncadia for Energy Northwest this week. Kind of labored with the decision whether or not to go. I think I will go. They say that they're going to take all safety precautions. So if I disappear, I'll be in quarantine somewhere. So come and get me. Anyway, that's all I had.
Well, if you're in quarantine, we're going to leave you there. Sorry.
Okay, Will, you're muted. But I think I'm next.
Okay. Well, let me just announce this one.
Okay.
Next item is staff reports, and the first item is plans for the upcoming BOC meetings, virtual and socially distanced. And that's you, Doug.
Okay. And this kind of came about. Jim had asked the question about when we'll start meeting in person again, but, you know, social distancing. And he doesn't really like handouts of his own documents to the other commissioners' staff during remote meetings. So that kind of we've already been following this, but that kind of wanted me to respond to this meeting. I, in particular, don't like the virtual meetings at all, and I'll be glad when we can eventually go back to normal, but when it's safe to do so. We've sent a question to APUDA about all the other PUDs, and we asked them, any of them, the PUDs, have an in-person board meetings as of yet, and if not, when do they think they will start? And that we'll get their response in about another week. Of the West Side PUDs, we actually met with them this last week, and out of all the West Side ones, only one has their doors open, and that's basically Pacific PUD. And so far, only the commissioners have been coming to the meetings. No public has come into the meetings at all. So they're still open, but with no public. The other PUDs in the West Side are still meeting virtually, and they don't really have any plans as of yet on when they'll open to the public.
Hey, Doug.
Yeah.
When you said there only the commissioners were meeting, are you referring just to Pacific or to other West Side PUDs?
Just Pacific.
Okay.
the other ones don't have any in-person meetings. And then we haven't heard of any on the other side yet of meeting in person, but that's what APUDA, when they sent out the search, we'll get answers on the east side too. And additionally, in the county, as far as we know, the county and the PA school districts is still having virtual meetings, and I believe SQUIM is too. We don't see any real emphasis in the county of meeting in person either. I assumed your EDC meeting was virtual too there, Jim.
Yeah, but that's a bunch of people. My first step is for at least maybe the three commissioners and a couple staff be able to meet there at the PUD building for the BOC meetings and have everybody else virtual. Phase into this thing.
Right. And then I guess the question, if we did happen to have open to the public meetings, we kind of looked down, and Sean did kind of a look in the boardroom there and figured out about 12 people would be the most that could social distance. And then the question comes up, though, if we had more than 12, do we turn them away? You know, how can you turn legally? Can we turn people away from a meeting? And I guess the other question would be is if people wouldn't refuse to wear or people refuse to wear masks, you know, what do we do? Do we, you know, we'd hate to call up the police and say, come and, you know, we have some customers that want to come to the meetings, but they refuse to wear masks. So I think until things in the county starts working out a little bit better, we're probably at this point in time not planning on having the meetings. And in regard to your question about handing out things in the meetings, I mean, if it was just the commissioners, you'd only be handing out to the commissioners. But you do have the option of emailing anything you want to handouts in advance to be included in the board packet. So we can include whatever you want in the board packet that goes out to the customers as well as to the commissioners. So that, I mean, that should take care of the concern you might have there.
Doug, what phase is Clallam in right now? Do you know? I haven't been following that.
Yeah, I think we're still in two. Sean, are you, you've been following that real close. Are we?
Yeah, we're still in two, and according to the governor's proclamation, at least our interpretation of it, we're only allowed to have five people in a group.
Yeah, that was my next question. Okay. So
okay.
It's kind of difficult to have a meeting with that kind of restriction on it.
Right.
Well, like I said, I think a good first step was just to basically have the commissioners and a couple of us, and then everybody else is virtual, and then, you know, that doesn't violate anything.
Okay, we can look into that or look in line regarding that.
You might check with the attorney on that one, too, as far as an open public meetings.
We're still present, an open public meeting.
Well, I know that, but if the commissioners and staff are there, and can you require public to be virtual? I'm just asking a question. I'm not
okay.
not a lawyer, so.
All right.
Okay. You want to move on to the next one there, Will?
This one is continue update on the 2020 key performance indicators. How many do we have left, Doug, and how long do you think it's going to take?
Yeah, we've got three left. We've got communications with Nicole. We've got safety with Larry, and then we have risk management, and Sean and John will update us on that. So we're probably maybe a half hour before that would be over.
Okay. All right. Well, let's dive into it then. Who's first?
You want me to go first, Doug?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead.
Okay, Sean, can you share screen? Allow me to do that? Let's see.
Yeah, you should be able to share now,
Nicole.
There we
go. Got it. Okay, let's see here. You don't want to see that. You want this. Can you see the PowerPoint slide, or are you seeing a picture on my desktop?
We can see the PowerPoint.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
We can see it.
So this is pretty quick. The first one is enhanced. Oh, let's see. Let me go back one. Here we go. Influence regulatory issues. And for this one, nothing much has changed because we've been able to maintain attendance at meetings virtually. So Green just makes sure that we've got our delegates assigned where we have regular attendance. And as far as I've been hearing from the ones I've been attending, plus what the commissioners have been reporting on, it sounds like we aren't missing anything at this point. I've just been reelected vice chair of the Washington PUD Association Communications Committee, and Communications and Government Relations had a roundtable last week to try to start planning for the next year. We're entering a new PUD Association fiscal year. And so we're looking at having some speakers. Right now we're working on speakers for September, and we're kind of looking at either somebody from the governor's office to talk to us about the situation with disconnects and late fees and such, or possibly somebody from the broadband office coming to speak to the telecom committee. So we've got some interesting things coming up there. We did do a little bit of a poll of the PUDs, just like Doug was talking about, and had the same results. The only Pacific, and then the only one on the east side we heard that was meeting in person was Okanagan.
Yeah, Nicole, you might want to eliminate PPC from that list.
Let's see, where did I... yep, you are correct. We will get rid of that one. Looks like WPAG is still meeting. Like where you have EDC attendance.
Yeah,
so,
PPC is still meeting, but they're really limiting participation in that. So.
Right. Okay, so of the ones of which we are members, we are in the green. As far as relevant quarterly communication in the hotline and the newsletters, we've been able to be flexible with that. We've had to ask for either something publishing early or something publishing a little bit late as needed to account for needing to get some timely information out, since we are trying, it's been a challenge staying ahead of the proclamations and making sure we get timely information out to customers. So far we've been successful. The next one that comes out, we have to have content in by next week, so that will be for the first week of October publication, and that's one of the challenges, is there's about a 30-day lead time. We can make minor changes after that. And this next one, we usually make that our outage edition, but we are going to try to also address if anything changes with the proclamations. Since the holding meetings in person is supposed to expire on September 1st, we are anticipating an announcement this week whether they're going to extend that or not. They're expecting potentially having that extended because the state of emergency has not been called off yet, but we want to be able to respond to that in the customer newsletter as well. Let's see, so the next one here, enhanced customer partnerships. This one is the one that while our in-person events have been canceled, and that's affected our strategic projects, as far as engaging with customers, we've actually had some really good success with our website and social media presence. Now, this was reporting on second quarter, which our unique visitors to the website are up over 200% compared to last year. But we have 85.6% new visitors. And as of second quarter, it was 196 unique page views of the new COVID customer support page. I checked on that before the meeting, and we now have had another 54 in the past week. It was 384 total visits to that page. Right now, employment is, as usual, the number one page because we just listed a customer service rep position. And since that's an entry-level position to the PUD, we usually get over 100 applications easily. Now, we have the new online CARES financial assistant application, and that has had 83 visits just since we launched it in the past week. I believe Shind has had 18 submissions via the online application. We were having a little bit of difficulty stressing that they have to upload supporting documentation, but we added a whole bunch of red flags to data to flag that so that customers can get that in. Because we have until October 15th to disperse the funds on that. As far as on social media, I also posted information there about the CARES application, and that's reached about 1,500 people and has had 142 engagements, meaning they shared it or clicked through. We've been lauded by a few of the other communicators and such because apparently a normal range for engagement on Facebook is of your population base, 8 to 10% liking your page, and we're up at 18% now. So that's also increased, and we're leveraging the content that gets shared by other things like BPA and WPPA and APPA provide content that we can share to help engage customers because they're online right now. That's their world, and they're looking for content and things to watch and things to educate them, and we'll also be switching gears that way towards energy savings, outages. And one of the things that we've just recently noticed, and it was from personal experience, is freezers are sold out everywhere, pretty much the entire peninsula down to Port Orchard and everywhere because people are stockpiling food. And as a result, Matthias and I put our heads together, and we're going to focus on some tips about energy savings and about freezers and about freezing milk jugs full of water in your freezer so that if there is a power outage, you don't lose all that food you stockpiled. But that's also an additional energy load for customer households, and we want to point that out too. So we've got some good tips we're preparing to roll out. Another thing we're talking about to engage customers is perhaps holding an electric vehicle educational Zoom. Utility Services has done a great job of in-person presentations in the boardroom prior to this, and so we want to see if we can do that as a virtual environment type of thing, and then we can record it and post the recording because we're looking at partnering with a new gentleman to town who's with an electric vehicle interest group and is really enthusiastic about helping us start to get some education out to customers about electric vehicles. And then that was the third KPI there. So we're still engaging with the trying to get some more content through some partnerships. Spoke with somebody about doing the electric vehicle wrap today, looking at some designs to get a message out on the wrap for the vehicle when it arrives. And then we still have some things going on virtually that we would have attended in person, like the Northwest Public Power Association Energy Efficiency and Communications Conference will be virtual. There's several of us attending that, as well as the APPA Customer Connections Conference. So we've got some things coming up. So we're green in all of these areas, and the only thing that we have not been able to do is have the events such as we would have had the fair. We missed the second home show. We're not going to be able to have Dungeness River Fest. So we're looking at some ways that we can get online, like I said, and do some videos and see what we can do for fourth quarter and then start planning for next year. And then lastly, some of the takeaways here. Early on, when we started with COVID, we took pictures of people working from their home, and the customers seemed to really enjoy that, and that was where we got our initial boost for social media for this year. We've had all the events canceled. This has been an opportunity to have discussions and education with customers about public power and local control, what with them putting us under the UTC as a contact point for customers, and Wapuda is working on that with the governor's office as well, trying to get a script for the UTC because several PUDs have experienced customers calling the UTC and basically being told there's nothing that they can do. So we want to see if we can't redirect the UTC to have a script that if a PUD customer contacts them to be directed to contact their PUD for assistance. Our advertising is standing out more. I've had several comments on that because other businesses, unfortunately, have had to curtail their advertising. And then the other challenge is just how to engage our own employees some more. I mean, we kind of see each other passing in the halls, but we didn't get to have an all-employee meeting. And I talked to the other PUDs last week, and we're looking at doing some little contests. Maybe it's find something on the website, so it's something that can help engage them in training as well as something fun that they can do. And we're going to be doing our regular photo calendar, so I've had several submissions on that. And they're having fun with that since people are out on the trails and enjoying the outdoor scenery more. So we're looking forward to that. And then I'm going to guess that we probably will not be able to do our annual retiree luncheon, which is a shame, but we'll see if we can find something that we can mail or engage with our retirees in that way. So that is all I have, if anybody has any questions.
Yes, Nicole, this EV advocacy, are we vetting that information before we send it out to our customers?
Yes, Matthias and I sat with him and watched his whole presentation last week, and I'm happy to share that with you guys. Before we do something like that, we would definitely run it by maybe have him come and present in either a board meeting or a work session.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's good to put good, logical, real information out if we're going to put the PUD stamp on it.
Yeah, and what he presented to us dovetails really well with the Choose EV content that we've put on our website.
Thank you.
Nicole, I have a question. One of our strategic initiatives under partnerships is use internal and external surveys to integrate feedback into the strategic plan and projects. What sort of external surveys have we done to solicit input on the strategic plan?
On the strategic plan?
Well, into the strategic plan.
Let me turn up my volume here a little bit more so I can hear you.
It's one of the strategic initiatives.
I have to look up and see. We normally do a survey every 3 to 5 years, and I'll have to look and see. The last one was before my time, so it might be 3 or 4 years old. Usually we solicit it through trying to get public to attend when we're having the discussions on something like the strategic plan and having them come and watch the presentation and provide input at that time.
Well, I think that the survey question should be aligned with the strategic plan. I'm not too sure that the public wants to get down into the nuts and bolts of our strategic plan, but they could if they like by attending meetings and so on.
Yeah, and we'll want, next time we do a customer survey, we'll want to match the questions to a certain percentage to our last ones so that we're comparing apples to apples and can see a change over time.
Right, but I think the general idea that there's publics out there that would be interested in maybe, is our strategic plan strategic enough? Is it forward-looking enough? Is it where is it? I mean, you've heard me say before that I think it's a really good and excellent management plan. It has some strategic, in my view, components, but there's some things that I think are truly strategic that may not be in here. So I'm just inviting, I would invite the public's comments early on and not just in response to whatever we write.
Yeah, I've got, after the KPIs are over, I've got a comment regarding that, Jim, and something that we're planning in the next few weeks, so a special meeting to have for everybody.
All right, thanks, Doug. That's all I have.
Okay, who's next?
We got Larry up next with safety.
Okay, Larry.
Work. I'm totally off here. Can you see, what do you see, just Zoom, or do you see my,
Zoom. Always seeing is Zoom.
I saw you for a second.
Oh, let me see, where are we? Come in.
See you now.
Yeah, there we go. You got it.
There you got it. He's got it.
Got it?
Yeah, I think we're going to follow this. Thank you. Well, go ahead and get started here. We're going to be talking about the safety culture. And building on our safety culture, it's, the definition of it is an ongoing safety mindset helps ensure employee and public safety. It also helps prevent injuries, casualties, and property damage, and minimizes the risk to the public and the district. The picture of excellence for this is our employees have safety every day and all day as their first concern. Safety as a culture is established. Compliance with all applicable regulations and recognized good industry practices while minimizing injuries, accidents, and property damage. District is recognized for a safety program, and the district is prepared for emergencies through the ERRP, which is the Emergency Recovery Response Plan. All of what I said is making sure that we follow whatever keeps us in compliance with governmental agencies. Now we'll go into our KPI. What we've done so far is we've kept the list of lost time injuries that are reported per this quarter. And in this quarter, we had none reported. So we're in the green for lost time. The next one is the recordable injuries. Recordable are items where you have more than first aid, back injuries, stitches, things like that. And we've had one injury, so that gives us in the yellow, but it was a prior injury before the quarter, but it was reported in the second quarter. And this was an old injury that he's working off of. So it does affect us even though some time back. And the third one down is our RP score. I really am glad that we have accomplished what we have here at the district. We've ended up in a green. We got 100%, 90% plus, so we're doing really well in the RP3 sector. Accident and injury reports submitted on time. When an injury occurs by an employee, they have 24 hours to fill out the paperwork and get it into their supervisor. Their supervisor has another 24 hours to fill their portion of it out, and then they get it into safety. There was a time there for a short period that we were getting L&I claims and we hadn't even received the injury reports, but that has totally changed. And this was done through nothing more than continuously bringing it up at safety meeting and tell them how important it is that we follow these, because we don't want to be looking bad out there. And the last one we have is completion of our online training. We are in the green on this. We've had 90% plus completion on the online training. The online training is basically safety for the administrative type people. They can do it monthly. We were doing it monthly. Some felt that they'd like to do it a little more at one time, like 3 months at a time. So we've given them that opportunity, but it's really on their shoulder to make sure they get it done on time. So overall, we're doing, I'd say, very well. We just got to keep working at instructing the employees to to stay on top of things. With what we've done here recently, staying home, this COVID thing, I've been out talking with crews. Those are the ones where we have most of our injuries because they're out there with equipment. And it seems like they are being a little bit more accountable for what they're doing. So I haven't seen the amount of injuries that we normally would have had at this time last year or years past. So it's just, I think it's brought them around to stay on top of things. So I'm glad to see that. Everybody's talking about safety all the time now. That was pretty much it that I had. Is there any questions, thoughts, concerns?
Yes, Larry. How do you handle near misses? Do you track those or kind of make people aware that you know, you came close to having an accident and what we can do to avoid those type things?
I have to go back a little bit on the history. In the past, they've had near misses reported, and it seemed like there was some disciplinary action prior to me getting here. Things have straightened up. And I remember the day that they first reported one, September 14th, 2014. We had a safety meeting. One of the guys stood up and said, I had a near miss. It was my fault and this, this, and this. The gentleman that worked for him is a lineman, journeyman. He stood up and said, it's not only on him, but it's on me. And building got room that definitely quiet. I just sat there and listened to him. To me, that was really important that they get up and acknowledge that they had a near miss, why they had the near miss, and how what they were going to do about it. And after we were done, it was total quiet. And they looked around at me, and I was like, keep going. I want to hear what's going on. How are we going to fix this? So at every safety meeting that we have, we review all of the injuries that we've had internally. And one of the questions we bring up is near misses. Has anyone had a near miss? And usually I like to take my time on that because if someone's feeling a little bit, well, maybe it's not quite a near miss or I don't really want to talk about it. And I'll mention it about 3 or 4 times, talk about it. Even if it's home, talk about it here. We want people to understand that safety is one of our top priorities. So a near miss, we follow up on with, is it something that was that we could do with engineering? Is it a process or is it a tool? Or is it just retraining that individual? Most of the time it's not. It's just a process that they're doing or they got lackadaisical about it. So that's kind of how we take care of it. I'm sorry for the long.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay.
Okay, we've got John and Sean up for risk management now.
Okay, give me just a second here. All right, can you guys see the KPI screen there?
Yep, looks good.
Okay. So after the departure of Simon, John and I both inherited the managed risk portion of the strategic plan. So this is the second quarter results. The definition for the managed risk is risk is exposure to the possibility of loss or other adverse or unwelcome effects on the district's objectives. Risk management is the process of identifying, analyzing, planning for, and monitoring and controlling risk. And our picture of excellence is the district meets or exceeds its key performance indicators for every strategic objective by knowing and controlling the risks of loss or other unwelcome results. And so the first part of the KPIs here is we measure how we're doing as far as on track with our strategic projects. And right now we're hovering around 70%. And unfortunately, we have something to blame it on, which is COVID. Because of COVID, we really had a slowdown since March through current on a lot of our strategic projects, primarily our capital projects. And so that has put us in the red for right now. And then the second portion here is claim events paid. I believe in the second quarter we had 2. And to be green, we have to have less than 7. So we're well within the green there, only having 2 claim events paid in the second quarter. So that's my quick part, and John's got the next piece here that's on ages.
Okay, Sean, I'm going to let you flip through the presentation. What is AEGIS? AEGIS is the PUD insurance underwriter. And as part of their process, every 3 to 4 years, they conduct a week-long on-site inspection. And they look at many of our programs, and they go out in the field and look at our system and whether we're actually following our administrative programs. The primary evaluation criteria is the National Electric Safety Code, often known as the NESC, which governs how we build and operate our electric system. And they also utilize what is called accepted good industry practices, meaning if the utility industry has a way of doing things that is time-tested, proven, safe, they start looking for consistency in how utilities operate. And there is some risk comfort in doing the industry norm. One of the things they do, they look very closely at the administrative programs that affect risk. And what I like about this inspection, they also have an engineer on site who actually goes out in the field, make sure that our equipment is labeled correctly, make sure our clearances are correct, both pole line, make sure that vegetation management, no encroaching into substation fence, that our substation fences are correct, that all the dimensions of equipment within a substation are correct according to the NESC. Earlier, we spent a lot of time on RP3 for reliability. We looked at AEGIS and that inspection as the QA for risk management. Next slide. Okay, the KPI, there's quite a few, I think 11 sections for the inspection. And if we get all topics evaluated satisfactory, we call that green. No more than one topic evaluated as needs improvement, that's a less satisfactory yellow. And if two or more topics are evaluated as needs improvement, we think we're in trouble. And unfortunately, the last inspection, we did receive a yellow because we had one area that needed improvement. Now, the previous AEGIS, we didn't have any need improvements on any categories. But this is a new category and was the first time that it was introduced by the AEGIS inspector. And we were not quite up to par on our call handling practices and procedures, although I do want to let you know that all recommendations have been implemented, so we have made corrective action. In a little more detail on that, basically, one of the tests and criteria they check us on is they actually make phone calls to our CSRs reporting a wires down. And their expectation is that a certain script and information is conveyed to the customer to guarantee safety, including communicating positively that you're not to approach within 30 feet of a down wire. You're not to attempt to fight the fire with water hoses, and to ask questions like, are there any injuries or people down? And when they made those calls, not all of our staff responded with all of the criteria, hence needs improvement. Next slide. Okay, on the good side, we were evaluated satisfactorily in the following areas. Everything having to do with distribution, transmission, substation design, construction, and inspection, all satisfactory. Vegetation management, up check on that. Pole inspection, joint use practices, that's communication contacts, and how we administer them, downwire dispatch procedures, how we handle such calls on our side and dispatch and system operations. They also look at public safety and awareness, whether we are communicating with the public. They look really hard at our environmental programs, oil PCBs and others, disposal of hazardous materials. They look at our contractor safety reviews and evaluations. That includes what we do to evaluate contractors, approved vendors. We check out the state LNI, ensure they're performing at an acceptable level. And, of course, occupational safety, which is entirely within our safety program, following up on the what we do for our employees, including things like arc flash training, pole top rescue, and innumerable requirements that as a utility we're obligated to perform. So the best comparable to AGIS is what we do with RP3, as I said before, for reliability. Any questions?
John, is there a category above satisfactory?
It's satisfactory and needs improvement.
Okay.
But I will say that the inspector has made comments to that effect that we are considerably above your average utility.
Right. And the other thing, these, well, you call them good industry practices, I would call them best practices, but what? How do you communicate that? How do you know what other utilities are doing?
Well, I mean, basically, that's part of our job. We read the literature. We work with APPA, NWPPA. We read the literature. So when something like, let's say, guy markers, where you put a polyethylene high visibility guard on a down guy, good industry practice, and we know about it, and we build such things into our standards. So once we become aware, we build it into our operational practices, we build it into our construction standards, and how we build things and how we operate things.
Sounds like you're doing a good job.
Any more questions?
No, good presentation.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Will, before we go on, I've got a couple of comments that I can make here, if that's okay.
Yeah, certainly. Go ahead.
Okay. We did get a comment regarding the in-person meetings that, you know, Colum has now moved from the moderate tier to the high-risk tier because of the recent increases in the cases. So that's something we keep an eye on, too, on a regular basis. And unfortunately, it had gone in the wrong direction here recently. Then to get back to what I mentioned I was going to discuss or just talk about real quickly, over the last two commissioner meetings, there have been a commissioner inquiries about what staff's doing to investigate emerging technologies with respect to, you know, power supply and in the strategic plan as well as planning, looking ahead in the future. Well, throughout 2019 and into this year, we've performed numerous informal scoping analysis in the light of CETA. CETA is a Clean Energy Transformation Act that we have to comply with, and also reviewing the upcoming BPA contract, technologies, trends, and innovations, and associated impact on strategic planning. This is consistent and beyond the work you're familiar with, not all of the commissioners and probably most of the public, but we've had grid modernization reports, decarbonization strategies. We had a presentation in a commissioner meeting last October, so we've been up on a lot of these things. And so what I'm trying to do is emphasize that we do periodic review and scoping. It's just part of what the district normally does. and it's an integral part of our job functions and effort to stay current with the technology and legislative changes. I mentioned that in the last meeting we were in, that it's just things that we do because we've been in the field for a long time and we stay up to date on it, and any potential impacts on our utility. So based on recent inquiries, we planned to update and provide a special meeting in the near future to cover these topics in more detail, not down deep into the weeds, but it's deep enough that we feel we need to have a special meeting, and we'll schedule that in upcoming meetings. Special meeting, the staff will look into different things with the CETA legislation, and again, into preparing discussions with BPA on future contracts. We'll look at large solar with and without battery backup. We'll look at community solar with and without battery backup. We'll look at small modular reactors, and we'll give an update on the solar battery microgrid projects that we have. So that's what we have planned, and like I said, in the near future, we'll go ahead and do that and give that presentation in a special meeting, probably not in a board meeting, but it'll be open to the public, of course, and it'll be a longer meeting. So that's why we believe we need to have a special meeting. So that's all I've got here to finalize the staff reports.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thanks.
All right, good. Thank you. Okay, action items, anything? Is T on? I'm sure she is.
T, I didn't hear anything. I don't know if T did.
I did not record anything. I didn't catch that anybody had anything other than another inquiry from Commissioner Waddell about strategic planning and involving the public. That's really all I had.
Okay,
that
good.
I captured.
Good, thank you. All right, our next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have somebody out there? Or?
And nobody in the chat, but if anybody would like to make a comment, go ahead and give me your first name now, and I'll go in the order received.
Christine.
Anybody else? Oh, okay, Christine.
I would just like to make a comment about, and I sent this in as a formal request as an email, and it has come up actually during our conversation here regarding documents that get discussed during our board meeting that we don't have access to or that aren't included in the packets. And previously, I have spent the time to get a public records request for them. But I was thinking if they're shared and distributed amongst the commissioners and between the staff, and it's part of the discussion of the meeting, if we couldn't have them as part of the packet.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think that was I got a feeling that was touched on today during the conversation. You know, and it's not the content, it's not the content so much as just the idea that if things are being distributed amongst each other, that we should actually maybe just have a heads up on what it is, you know.
I think most things are distributed. Some things do come up at the last minute that
right.
aren't exactly. distributed. And then we try to get it into the package at the end with our minutes. So the public does have opportunity to see everything that was presented.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Sean, do we have others?
I heard no others.
Okay, well, good. We're going to recess from this meeting and join to an executive session. Sean, you can handle as far as excluding folks that shouldn't be in the executive session.
Yeah, so the public is aware, I'm going to place everybody into the waiting room, and then if anybody wants to stay on, and hear the adjournment of the meeting, we'll bring you back in.
Yeah, and I don't believe there's going to be any decisions made after the executive session. So.
Yeah, let me add to that two things. One, we don't record the executive session, so that'll be turned off. And then there's no action anticipated out of this executive meeting. So When we come out, normally what we would do is we would just go to Will would adjourn the meeting. So you can stay on if you want for that or not. It's your choice.
Here, let's take a few minutes to get organized for that, and then we'll come back at, say, a quarter till three. How's that?
Yep, that'll give me enough time.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Will, this is Christine. I have a question for you specifically.
Okay.
Have you
This is not an assignment, is it?
No, that's not me. Trust me, that is not me. I don't have that much. Anyway, have you heard about the book, The Apocalypse Factory, that's out by the author from Seattle?
Oh, gee. Sounds like heavy reading.
No, it really wasn't. It was one of the best books I've ever read. It took me 2 days to get through it. I couldn't put it down. It's about Hanford. But it's this subpart to its title is Plutonium and the Making of the Atomic Age, and it was fabulously interesting.
Oh, yeah. I've heard most of that story. I'm not sure about the book, but it is an interesting story. I mean, the fact that just huge effort in very short time, tens of thousands of people, just amazing.
It's amazing what created that. And the gentleman that wrote it was actually was raised in Othello.
Oh, really?
So he grew up, it's pretty interesting. But if you have an opportunity, it's a pretty quick read, too.
Yeah, driven through Othello. He has my sympathy.
As a kid, he loved it, you know?
yeah, probably a good place to grow up. Okay, well, we'll break now. Thank you, Christine.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Recording now, so we're out of executive session now, Will.
Okay, good. All right, if no other business to come before the commission, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.